to Fiber Hooligan. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesse, and for the next hour or so, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage of choice, and settle in for the 48th episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos, and I'm broadcasting live from my home here in Harrisburg, South Dakota. It's great to be back with all of you. We had a week off. We were all at Stitches South in Atlanta. I missed you. It's good to be back with you. And what can I say? Those weeks when I don't get a chance to talk with all of you, it's as much fun as Stitches is. It would be great to be able to do both. And maybe we'll work on fixing that at some point. Okay, well, let's get to the show today because I'm very excited. My guest today is a very cool lady, a friend, and somebody that's really a visionary in the world of technology and bringing that to the fiber arts world. She grew up amongst engineers, dad and brother, and summer jobs. She got an English degree, then worked for some R&D tech companies before 1990, becoming, as far as she knows, the first woman to sell printed circuit boards in Canada, having become interested in knitting 2 years before, and we'll talk more about that. After 7 years, she decided that she would rather sell yarn instead of torpedo and telecommunications parts. So she became an outside sales rep selling yarn to yarn stores in the Toronto area. In 2005-2006, she became frustrated by having to go to 40 different websites to find PDFs to buy and then remember what she had seen on each site. She wanted a kind of Barnes & Noble's for knit and crochet PDFs, and there just wasn't one. It occurred to her that she might be well-placed to do it, you know, with her techie background, techie friends, and lots of knitting contacts by then. So patternfish.com was incorporated in October of 2006 and launched a year and a half later in June of 2008. Since then, patternfish.com has become the largest pay-only site on the Internet for knit and crochet designs with over 6,000 top-notch patterns from hundreds of fine publishers, both corporate and indie, including Sidar, Knitting Pure and Simple, Mirasol, Prism, Classic Elite Yarns, Lucy Neatby, Ann Hansen's Knit Spot, Rowan, both the Noro and Debbie Bliss magazines, Cabin Fever, Berge de France, the UK Hand Knitting Association, and many others. Over 6,000 of these patterns are exclusive to patternfish.com as digital downloads, so there are a lot of unique things to see there as well. I'm speaking of my friend, Julia Gronau. Julia joins us this morning from Toronto. Good morning, Julia, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Benjamin. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. And I just have to say I'm flattered to bits that I'd be in the august company. I've been looking over the previous podcast participants, and it's just daunting. It's just incredible. Anyway, I'm really excited.
I'm excited to have you here, too. You are the third Canadian that I've had on the show at this point. You joined the ranks of Steve Malcolm from It Takes Balls to Knit and, of course, Fiona Ellis from there in your hood. No pressure, because, you know, they were all terrible guests, as you probably can imagine.
Especially Fiona with that irritating English accent.
Oh, I know. The thing about Canadians that I love, well, there's lots of things I love about Canadians, is that, you know, when you first look at them, you can't tell they're foreigners, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's to your that's to your credit.
It is, but we are deeply subversive in many ways, you know. We're on a, it's
you
like
know, it,
Will McAvoy said on the newsroom, we're on a mission to civilize. Progress is slow, but we're in it for the long haul.
And it's funny that you say that. That is one of my favorite shows. At Stitches Midwest or East, Pamela Hashke and Jeannie Randolph got me a shirt that said, I'm on a mission to civilize, which I think is awesome because I love that show. It's a great show. It's sad that this is going to be the last season for it, and then it's going to go off the air, which is just too darn bad because it's so good. I'm waiting for it to start
it
up
is.
Again. But anyway, we won't get into all that. So how are things in Canada today?
Things in Canada today are glorious. In Toronto, well, of course, we've all had this dreadful winter, you know, the winter capital, the winter capital. Oh, my God. But it's over, and our driveway ice is finally gone, and of course, you know, the spring is starting, and that gives us time in the industry, since we tend to be seasonal, to, you know, plan out what we've got coming up for the fall. So it's really an exciting time for us.
Right, right. And we're all, you know, those of us who are, I assume you're going to TNNA in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for the fiber hooligans that don't know, TNNA, and I've talked about this before on the show, TNNA is the National Needle Arts Association. It's a wholesale trade show, and it usually happens in June in Columbus, and this year it's happening in May in Indianapolis, and it's been a year since we were in Indianapolis. I've heard from friends of mine that the last time it was in Indianapolis, it was actually a great show, so we're all looking forward to that. It's always fun. It's not a stitchy show where people get to come and buy stuff, but, you know, lots of yarn stores and designers, and, you know, and then they even let people like me in the door, which, you know, no accounting for taste, but, you know.
It's to their enormous credit. They know what's good for them.
Oh, yeah, right. No, but Julia will be there to, you know, offset, you know, the downward spike that from my presence. But, okay, enough about me. Let's talk about you. Let's give the Fiber Hooligan listeners a little background about you, in case they don't know about you. Let's tell them, you know, who you are, where you're from, and where you went to school.
Well, I was born in Montreal, where my dad was just about to start working with Hewlett-Packard to expand their first presence in Canada. He set up their first sales offices here. Then we moved to Palo Alto, where my brother was born, so he has dual citizenship. My dad continued to work with Hewlett and Packard themselves, and then we moved back to Toronto, another place in Toronto, Montreal, Princeton, New Jersey, back to Montreal, countryside north of Toronto. And then I went to school, to university, actually, at Queen's, which is in Kingston, between Toronto and Montreal, which are about 5 hours apart by car. And then after graduating from Queen's, I went and lived in Italy for a year, year and a half, came back here, and I've been more or less in Toronto since 1984-85. And
wow.
So that's basically it. I have an English degree and grew up kind of like an Army brat.
Well, so you're a Hewlett-Packard brat.
Actually, yes, yes, yes. And we always had wonderful HP products and around the house and got to test drive some stuff, and that was fun.
Yeah, but I think you might be a Mac person now, right?
You know what? Strangely enough, not, because of course, lots of people, and in fact, the most creative people in the industry I know always are Mac people, but my partner is very much a Linux and Android kind of guy. So we have, I don't know, 9 computers in the house, and all but one of them have a Linux or Unix platform. And I'm the only person who works on a Windows machine because, frankly, that's what most of the vending audience has. Well, that and Mac, of course, but...
Well, that's nothing wrong with that, and we won't hold it against you that you're not a Mac person. Really, we won't, because there's a lot of PC people out there. My business partner Bernie at Hopscotch is nothing but PC, and you know we managed to get along. You know, so it's going to be fine. But I want to step back for a second, because you said that you spent a year in Italy, and you know, for those people who have heard me talk about Italy, you know, it's an awful place. The people aren't very friendly.
However awful it is. You know, the thing about the Italians is that they don't feel they can count on the future. Like, their stock market's kind of a joke, and trying to plan anything is difficult. So if you had to distill everything, the fact of the matter is that their day-to-day life is as good as they can make it. So all the clothes that you have to put on in the morning, the furniture that you sit on during your day, your workspace, the architecture, certainly the food, that's all as good as they can make it, because they really don't feel that, you know, they can count on a long-term investment in the future. So it's interesting from that point of view, and therefore a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah, I spent 3 or 4 weeks there, and I think I agree. I don't think it's somewhere I would live, but it certainly was a magical time for me to visit, and I found the people just incredibly gracious, you know, other than, you know, the people that, you know, stole my dad's wallet and passport, but that's a whole other story. We won't get into that. That happens.
You know,
anywhere,
the Italians themselves would say that those would be immigrants from another country. Okay.
They actually did say that. They absolutely said that at the police station. I remember that. Yep. Well, and I think that that's actually a realistic thing, that does happen. But Italy for a year. Wow. I mean, that would have been.
I was lucky. I studied Italian at the University of Siena, Italian for Foreigners, and then. At the time, I was going out with a guy who was a drug representative for the Dutch drug company Organon, And so after a while, he would take me on his calls. He would have to go to, like, little town, tiny little unknown towns in Tuscany, and I would go with him for the day or the afternoon or whatever and just explore wherever we were, and then, you know, we would go back to Siena at the end of the day. And I saw an enormous amount of Tuscany that I just would not have seen any other way, and it was a godsend. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, it sounds amazing. I mean, you know, a year is not too long to explore Italy. Trust me, folks, it's not nearly enough time. It's a magical place. I can't say enough about it. But, you know, I sort of like the U.S. and Canada too, especially Canada. You know, I'm partial to Canada. I go
do.
Up there every
you went
year.
So far as to demonstrate your affection for Canadians by marrying one. Congratulations, yay you!
Well, not only that, but, you know, I produced another one when, you know, we were up in there. My daughter was born in Canada. Actually, my wife did most of the work on that. But still, you know, I brought another baby into the world. Every year, I think last year was the first year in probably 12 years that I didn't spend some time in British Columbia. I don't spend too much time in Toronto. I don't seem to know anybody there except you now. So now I'll have to come up and visit you.
Fiona Ellis lives here too.
Actually,
you know, the knitting in Toronto community is enormous. We have Amy Singer, who founded knitty.com. We have, of course, Fiona. We have Kate Atherley. We have just Robin Hunter. We have masses of, you know, designers and talent and great yarn stores. So it's actually quite a hub. I would say one of the North American hubs for knitting activity.
Yeah, well, I think you've got a gal named Stephanie up there that people may have heard of too.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. The yarn, Harlot, that's it. Yarn Harlot. Stephanie Pearl McPhee. She lives here too.
Yeah. I just wanted to throw it out there because I thought maybe one or two of my listeners might have heard of her before. But all right.
Or
so,
have bought all
so
of her
got,
books like all the rest of us.
Have bought all of her books like the rest of us. Yeah, she's pretty talented. All right, so I got off on a tangent here. Let's talk about your professional career, not in the fiber arts world. So you got out of school and you did some interesting things. And I always say nobody gets into the industry right out of school. That's not quite true, but for the most part, people don't come into the industry out of school. They have to go do other things. What other things did you go do?
Well, I, of course, grew up with my dad, who was an entrepreneur in tech and stuff like that, and my mom was one of those Geminis who did every possible kind of handwork you can think of. She did weaving and sewing and tatting and crocheting and knitting. She was a wonderful knitter and black work and cross stitch and embroidery and all this stuff. So, in other words, I had been exposed to fiber arts at home through my mother, but I had, you know, a working techie background from my dad. So when I moved back from Italy, I looked for a job in the tech sector, and that was hard for someone with an English degree. So I landed up doing various things and managing an R&D company for a couple of years, just doing everything that wasn't technical. And then I landed up signing with a temp agency with Drake. And they placed me at the head office of a company that owned several circuit board manufacturing facilities. And long story short, I landed up being in inside and then outside sales, selling complex printed circuit boards, like 18-layer backplanes, controlled impedance, blind and buried vias, all that kind of thing, to the telecommunications and military industries. So I always had all of Canada as a territory, but then sometimes Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas as well. So I got to go to Texas and Austin and Houston and Dallas specifically a few times to go sell them our board manufacturing abilities.
So you I said in your bio that you were involved with torpedoes, and again, the military industry, and I assume that's the United States, and the reason I assume that is because when I lived in Canada, I once went to the West Edmonton Mall, at the time the largest mall in America. Yeah. And the West Edmonton Mall was famous before there was the Mall of America as the largest mall, and one of the things it was famous for is that it had four submarines, none of them with torpedoes, I assume, although, you know, when you're dealing in the tourism industry, it's not always a bad idea. And so the point that I'm trying to get to is that it was famous for having these four submarines, which just happened to be one more than the Canadian Navy had. So my guess is you weren't selling torpedoes to the Canadian Navy.
No, we were not. We were selling torpedoes to various military divisions of Westinghouse. Westinghouse actually does have military or subcontracted divisions for that, and Rockwell and places like that. And in fact, I remember being in the offices of Rockwell during the first Gulf War in Texas. And because I was a non-U.S. citizen, when I first arrived there, I was ushered off into this little room where, of course, I had to give my passport number and fill out all these forms and before they would let me into the building. And all the while, I was sitting there thinking, you know, we never heard of an enemy Canadian. They don't exist. There's no such thing as an enemy Canadian. And didn't we get your hostages out of Iran? You know, I mean, but eventually they did let me in. But I arrived in Dallas at Love Field on the Love Airline Southwest on Valentine's Day, if you can believe it. So I have good memories of that.
Well, good. Well, good. Yeah. It's hard to think of, you know, the Canadians as, you know, hostile force to the north, but, you know, we're going to keep our minds open, Barbara Hooligans, you know, just in case, just in case. You know, I always tease my dear wife, Krista, that, you know, there's no, you know, there's no malevolence coming from Canada. It's just where all the cold air comes from, you know, and
it's true.
And that she scowls at me and says, no, it's not. But she's listening right now, so I threw that in just so she can scowl at me. All right. So you moved on. You were doing this, and you were knitting while you were still doing this. You became a knitter.
I was, yeah, because my mother was so expert at everything. I didn't really want to take up any of her crafts while I was living at home, although I was certainly exposed to all of them. So it wasn't until I moved out of home, and then, you know, if you grow up feeling that it's sort of vaguely sinful or wrong to sit around in front of a television with nothing in your hands, and you do eventually look around for something to do. And I remember buying my first copy of Vogue Knitting, which I think was the Holiday 88 issue. And after that, you know, just being very serious about it, wanting to learn, making stupid decisions like deciding to make mittens out of a cotton linen blend yarn, which was really dumb. But, you know, just getting more and more into the craft, into the different disciplines, into, you know, cable stitches. By the way, I avoided doing cables for 7 years because some well-meaning person told me that they were hard. And then, of course, when I finally did it, I was thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe that it's this simple. And I avoided it because someone said they were difficult. So to anyone who might be listening to this conversation, don't be scared. Go out there and do stuff. Try stuff. You'll surprise yourself more often than not about how easy things can be. So,
well,
yeah,
I agree. Please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I just became more and more interested in it. And whereas my mom, being a Gemini, was, you know, just spread across all these wonderful disciplines and did them all beautifully, I really focused in on knitting because, I don't know, it just rang a bell with me somehow. So all through my printed circuit board career, if we had, you know, corporate retreats or something like that, I would always bring my knitting. And all the other guys would just kind of stare. And I would say, well, you know, when you chop wood or you do something that's, you know, traditionally masculine, don't you get this warm feeling thinking, that, you know, you're doing something for your family and your loved ones to, you know, better their quality of life. Well, that's what this is. And I think they got it, you know. It's not something you have to explain to people in the fiber arts.
No, you really don't. And, you know, you're probably not the first person to bring out the knitting in the middle of a meeting and have everybody stare at you for a while. I've heard that story many, many times from lots of people. So, but, you know, I assume that they didn't get in your face too much, and they let you knit during your meetings and, you know, your retreats and things like that. No one ever told you to put your knitting away, right?
Absolutely not. No, no. And I think, frankly, that, you know, in this respect, I probably benefited from, you know, an extreme social consciousness. Like, you know, maybe if I'd wanted to breastfeed, they would have let me do that too. I don't know. But no, there was never any flack. Never.
Well, so at some point you decided to stop in the world of technology and get into the world of yarn. Can you talk about how that all came about? What was the mindset? I mean, what led you to that?
Well, I landed up spending 7 years in outside sales for two different printed circuit board companies. And then when I turned 35, the latter part of 1995, I really sort of took a step back and thought, you know, what do I really want to do? Because, you know, something's going to evolve as a career. And I was lucky enough to be able to take a few months off because my partner had gotten a very good paying job, and so I could take some time off, and I thought and thought about what I wanted to do. And at the end of a few months, I thought, well, I really like sales, but if I could sell anything in the world, what I would want to sell is yarn. And I didn't know anything about the industry or how to get into it or how it worked. I knew that I was a customer of yarn stores, and that was great, but I didn't know how to get into it, so I had to find out. So I went to the owner, whom I knew by sight, of the largest yarn store in the city, and I went and asked her if she would be kind enough to take 10 or 15 minutes out of her day to talk to me about it, and she did. And she described that there were distributors that the yarn stores bought their product from, and the distributors got their product from mills and so on. So she described the hierarchy as it was then. And I asked her if she would be so good as to put together lunches for me and anyone in the industry she wanted to introduce me to. And I would pay for these lunches, and I would hope to get a job in the industry that way. And she did this, and the very first lunch that she put together was with S.R. Kurtzer, at the time a distributor of yarns in Canada. They had Lopi and Ousterman and some other lovely lines, Classic Elite. And I ended up going to work for Kurtzer. So, and it was actually quite quick. It was within about 6 weeks, I think. And as it turns out, I ended up taking over the president's job. He had been on the road, and I ended up going on the road in his stead. So, and that was just an instant joy because I was able to make the sales calls I was familiar with, but I was able to sell a product that I absolutely adored and believed in and knew. And, you know, when you're selling to the military industries, it's maybe a little bit harder. So that's how I got into yarn.
Well, and I think that's interesting. You know, there's kind of two points that I'd like to make from that. You know, the first of all is people don't know just what a centralized hub Toronto was for the yarn industry with Kurtzer and all the designers. I mean, it really was a happening place, as happening as any city in North America.
It was, and Emily Way was setting up I think, was it the Knitlist, or I can't remember the name of the site. But anyway, we had people here who were carrying the flag before people knew that there were flags to carry. It was just an inspiring place to be. There was always a hotbed and rumblings and people feeding off one another and learning and, you know, taking classes. And Sally Melville, too, of course, lives just an hour away in Waterloo, Ontario, so she was traveling around giving classes and we were big enough as a city. Like, we have more than 4 million people in the Greater Toronto Area, as many as 6 million, depending on how you want to count it. We were big enough that the enthusiasm never died down. We didn't experience the same kind of slump to the same depth that the industry had, frankly, been in since 1985. So luckily, we always had that energy and the synergy going on.
Well, that's kind of interesting, too, because at the time you came into the industry was experiencing probably a 12 to 13-year slump.
It was, and in fact, one of the things that Marilyn Leonard said was, when I was first talking to her about getting into the industry, she said, are you sure your timing is all it could be? Because, you know, there's a bit of a slump going on right now, and she said, you know, understating the case somewhat, and I said, well, that's when you need good salespeople, is when there's a slump. And she just gave me a little fish eye and said, look, I don't care how good a salesperson you are. This slump has lasted for 15 years, and you by yourself are not going to fix it. She said it in the nicest possible way, but I think she made her point in that, you know, we didn't expect this to be, you know, a way that you were instantly going to be able to make a $500,000 a year. And I said, you know, I don't care. I want to do this. And she sort of threw up her mental hands and said, okay, well, go with God. That's great. So, yeah, there was definitely a slump. And so I think there's a certain, Benjamin, you know about this because you've kind of grown up around it, but there's a certain special camaraderie amongst the people who have been in the industry before, say, 2000 or 2003 when it really started to take off. You know, if you were in it, you know, when things were looking bleakish, or at least not prosperous, then you remember, you know, what it was like before and what it was like after, and you've got a really good sense of perspective. And you also know who's in it for the long haul.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, you make a good point, and that's something, let's circle back around in a different way, because there are so many people that maybe don't understand the way that the industry used to work, because the industry now is so radically different than the way it is right now. Everything was very top-down. You started from the distributor, and that's the way that it moved down, and that's really not the way that it works anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to look around when I first started, and the distributors would pretty much dictate the choices that the retailers had, and the retailers would make their choices from, you know, a fairly small buffet. And yes, different stores would tend to concentrate in different things depending on what their own clientele wanted or what their own what the owner's tastes were. But right now, it has done a 180-degree flip. And the customers and the yarn store owners themselves are saying to the distributors and the fiber community in general, this is what we need. This is what we want. We will pick from what, you know, we can find ourselves if you can't offer it to us. And in many cases, even if it does come from, you know, the traditional distribution sources, the local yarn store and the customer will opt to buy more locally, maybe from smaller companies, and that's been just an astonishing thing to watch. It must be like, you know, being around at the introduction of the automobile, or where society just completely changes, and the process of watching it has been fascinating, and yet it's been very quick, very quick. Even since Patternfish went live in 2006, we've just seen a huge change in the industry, so much, and it's really been just a matter of, you know, 6 or 7 years.
Well, it has been, and of course this is all internet-driven. I mean, there wasn't the same methodology to bring things to market. You know, traditionally in the old days, distributors would go to a place like TNNA, they'd sell it to the yarn stores, and that's how the end consumer would find this. And now we have huge internet communities which have brought so many people together and allow people information and access to things that, you know, there is so much information it's hard to process. You know, and I think that it's a good thing, because there were some things that were maybe not the most wonderful things in the world back in the old days. There were people in the sales organizations of a lot of companies that didn't actually know much about fiber arts or the yarn itself, but sold it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I have a couple of good stories. When I first came on to Kurtzer, everyone was kind of surprised and really quite pleased that I could knit and that I knew what I was talking about, because one of my predecessors had gone on the road telling all the local yarn store owners that DK stood for Danish knitting, which, of course, is ridiculous. I mean, you know, but he didn't know, and he thought he could cover up, you know, his ignorance by just making stuff up. And maybe that worked at one time. I don't know. And I worked with another fellow who was on the phone and also working for my company. And he put his hand over the receiver and he said, Julia, do we have any four-ply yarns? And I said, well, do you mean four-ply as in like a sock weight, or as in actually having physically four plies? And he went back to his phone and he came back and said, sock weight. And I said, oh, you mean like Fortissima that we've been distributing for 10 years with 218 colors? You mean that kind of a sock yarn that's a four-ply? And he said, holy cow, that's a four-ply? And I said, yes, it is. He got back on the phone and I guess sold, you know, a ton of it or whatever. But the point is that people in the industry couldn't always be counted upon to know certain things that we consider very basic now. So I always thought that was
important. Well, yeah. Well, I agree. It's almost, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, I think that the fiber arts public is now also much more savvy than they were. That they know more. They have access to more. They learn so much more quickly. And so, there's a demand. I think so, too. But along the way, we saw some deficiencies out there, and this is where I kind of want to start talking about you. I want to talk about Patternfish, because I love it. I've said to many people that it is the equivalent of iTunes for knit and crochet PDFs. So let's tell our people a little bit about patternfish.com. Let's start with this. What was the motivation? Why? Why do it?
Well, I have to get back to both my dad being an entrepreneur and kind of bringing us up with my brother and me with this lovely motto from Rudyard Kipling's Rikki Tikki Tavi story, which is, you know, run and find out, dear. You know, like, just, you don't have to take what's going on necessarily, that it's not as hard as people think to change things. And I remember 2004, 2005, 2006, thinking that, you know, I've got all this, and this is just when the hand-dyed stuff started to really, really permeate the market. And, of course, the hand-dyers didn't necessarily always have access to, you know, elaborate pattern support. And so I remember at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and this is key, actually, that it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, marching towards my computer with this gorgeous huge hank of some hand-dyed Aran thing from Fleece Artist under my arm, and sitting down and thinking, okay, I want to make some sort of a child's garment with this hand-dyed, and suddenly realizing as I sat down that, you know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I couldn't phone anyone, and I could go to a large number of different sites and try and find a PDF that I was perfectly happy to buy. In fact, you know, was delighted to buy, but I would have to make elaborate notes about which site I had been to and what they had available, and then I'd have to go back and make a choice. And I thought, you know, I want a collection of PDFs out there that I can choose from. And maybe it wouldn't be only me. Maybe this would be useful for all kinds of people. And I thought this was a pretty terrific idea if there were, as you said before, a Barnes & Noble kind of approach to things where I could just go to essentially a PDF store and choose amongst all the PDFs and say, okay, I want to make a sweater for a boy, and I want it to have a V-neck and a hood and raglan sleeves, for example. And I wanted to be able to key in those factors and have it return a bunch of things from all kinds of different people that would meet those criteria. And there wasn't anything like that. So I went around and I thought, this is a good idea. And I went around and tried to run this idea past a few people. And, you know, the yarn store said, well, you know, that sounds okay, although a little far-fetched. But, you know, we don't have the resources to, you know, work on something like that. And then the distributor said, well, you know, we're very busy with our distribution and stuff, and nobody's done this kind of thing before, and, you know, it could be a little awkward. And I was desperate to find somebody who could put this in place, who could, you know, make this for me, you know what I mean? So, and therefore, by extension, for other knitters who might be in the same boat. And over the course of a few months, it gradually began to dawn on me that maybe I would have to be the one to do it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, okay, well, I have the programming contacts because I had, you know, spent all this time growing up amongst engineers and working in tech. I knew a lot about the knitting world, and I knew publishers who might conceivably be interested in publishing PDFs on a site like this. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, well, you know, maybe no one else is going to be as motivated as I would be. So, because I remember my mom saying one time that, you know, a marriage wasn't going to work unless it was priority one for at least one of the two people at any given time. And I couldn't think of whoever else this might be priority one for a long stretch, or even at all. But it was for me. So I thought, well, maybe I have to be the one. And I happened to have an excellent programmer friend who was in between gigs and had amassed a nest egg from previous work. And he said, you know, I would be interested in writing this for you. And I said, great. And then we just started to work on it, speccing it out and putting it together. So, and it was very speculative. I didn't know at all if it was going to fly. And I remember talking to my partner, Greg, to see if there was going to be any way to make this work. And I was concerned. And he very, very gently one time said, okay, let's assume all patterns can be sold for $3. And, you know, and you need a certain amount to take home every month to make this viable and make sure that, you know, everyone gets the commission they're entitled to and that there's still enough to run the site on. He said, can you sell 3 patterns at $3 per state per day? Can you do that? And that sounded very reasonable when he put it that way. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, that sounds manageable because, you know, if you think in terms of, well, I'd have to sell, you know, 10,000 and high numbers like that, it's daunting. But when he said 3 per state per day, it, just the way he put it, I thought, okay, you know, you gulp, you gather yourself up and say, okay, that's doable. Now you just have to put one foot ahead of the other.
Right, and so you know, when you originally got started, you had some resources yourself. You were already working with some patterns and some companies, and that's where you started. Can you talk a little bit about that early collaboration with those companies?
Well, here again, you know, just talk about luck because because I had been a rep for years. When you're a rep, you're given samples twice a year of, you know, the seasonal offerings from any given company. As I said, we had some beauties from Classic Elite, from the Istex, Alifos, Lopi people, and Stylecraft, and many others. And so because I love to design, I was a hopeless designer myself, but by golly, you know good design when you see it. I had never thrown any of these out. I always kept my samples. even if yarn quality was discontinued, I always kept the patterns I had gone with that because they were just beautiful. So what I was able to do, once Patternfish, the idea of it and the programming started to come together, is I was able to go to these people and say, look, we've got this idea, and it's crazy, but it just might work. And here's the idea, that I take your old print patterns and scan them and make them into a PDF format, and you guys don't have to do anything. And then we'll just agree on a retail price and a percentage and stuff like that, and then I'll go ahead and sell them on your behalf, and then every month I'll send you money. And they said, what do we have to do? And I said, nothing, not a damn thing. You just sit there. All I need is your permission to scan your past work. And they all said, you mean people would buy old patterns? And I said, and even our current stuff, and, you know, like online, they would do that. And I said, yeah, I really think they would. So all I need is your permission to go ahead and do this. And so the, you know, smarter of, I don't want to say smarter, you know, but they were, you know, the ones who had vision or just trusted me, God bless them, said, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, sure, take our catalogs and go ahead and scan them, and then, yeah, we'll sell them for XYZ amount of money, and we'll trust you to sell our patterns. And one thing that we did do and one thing that we built into the site from the very beginning was to make sure that at any given time, any publisher or designer who listed patterns with us could see all their sales happen in real time. They could dial in at any, they could go onto the site and look at any moment of any day and see what they had sold into Finland or into Czechoslovakia or South Africa or, as has happened, the Falkland Islands. And they'd be able to see exactly what we owed them, what patterns were selling, and they would know on a moment-by-moment basis, you know, exactly what they could look forward to by the 15th of the following month. And I gather at the time that that was kind of unprecedented, but when, you know, you have the background of having worked as I did in a retail store while being a rep, seeing things from the rep's point of view, the distributor's point of view, the designer's point of view, I felt that that transparency was really, really important. And people were really heartened by that. That made a big difference, that they could see what was happening, you know, when it happened. And, of course, that's still the case. We still have that, except that there's just more data to look at because we have way more sales. Oh, by the way, I just want to point out that right now, as of this moment, we have over 16,250 patterns on the site. So I think at the beginning you said 6,000, but it's really 16,000 and more.
Sorry, I think I said 6,000.
No worries. Yeah.
Wasn't it 6,000?
Yeah, but as a matter of fact, it's just over 6,000 that are exclusive. More than
right,
a third of
I
them
mean.
Are, yeah, yeah, of course, more than a third of them are exclusive to us on the Internet. You won't find those patterns anywhere else. So if for example, you were to go to our shop page, so just go and look at the shop page, patternfish.com, click on shop, and then click on the other category, you can go and look by all the web and world exclusives that we have. And it's just a magnificent, very high-quality assortment of work.
Well, I agree, and I think that, you know, one of the things that first of all, the growth is something you should be congratulated on because it means that you were right, and this was exactly what people wanted.
Thank you.
And,
good
you know,
timing. We were so lucky.
Well, you know, I think a good idea is a good idea no matter when it comes out, but I agree you had some good timing as well. And the one thing I love about your site, and this is something that, you know, is kind of near and dear to my heart, I'm not the biggest fan of free patterns. I think that the occasional free pattern as a, you know, here's a you know, a nice thing to give is a great idea. There's every so often a special that you want to do. But I believe that good patterns should be, for the most part, sold. That, you know, that makes sure that yarn companies and designers and everybody gets paid. And there's also a
we are clearly on the same page here, Benjamin.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there would be no reason for our site to exist. It drove
right.
me crazy when I was going around and looking that when I was a rep, I would occasionally be involved in, you know, someone would say, I need a pattern developed. And what the designers were being paid back then to design, knit, and write a pattern and grade it in maybe six sizes was scandalously low. It infuriated me. And I thought, you know, and that's a one-time payment, so they'll never see any royalties out of it. What if, you know, a pattern could be sold on a royalty basis, and people might actually have a chance of making a mortgage payment from one pattern. And they can and have and do on Patternfish. I mean, that in that respect, making their work available in this way – is a step not only towards providing independent incomes, but always valuing the work that the designer is doing. And, you know, it didn't used to be that much of a big deal. People would take patterns for granted, and they maybe look down on them a little bit. When I felt and still do feel that a lot of them are art, and whether or not the yarn that the pattern was created for still exists, you know, the original framing, you know, the treatment of that yarn, was just so extraordinary that the pattern could not be allowed to disappear, because that used to happen. You know, the patterns used to just be tossed when, you know, a quality of yarn was discontinued and its life was over. Then people assumed that the patterns were dead too. And that also drove me mad. I mean, if you wander through any gallery or any museum, things don't get thrown out because they're old. You know, you preserve them because they're beautiful.
So. Right, I agree. Well, not only that, there's another side to this as well. You know, and we can relate it to the music industry. iTunes is a perfect example. A lot of times when people go out and steal music, it's because they can't get it any other way. And I actually tend to think that most people are pretty decent people. And if they can go find something and pay a few bucks for it, they'd rather do that. And so I see the repurposing of these patterns that are no longer supported by the manufacturer or the supplier because of the yarns up on Patternfish is an anti-theft thing as well.
It is. And, you know, one thing that came up when we were talking about getting the site established with the various publishers was that people were worried that their work was going to be stolen or pirated or emailed to people. And I had to go and be able to say to them, and this was true then and is true now, that nothing can happen to your work in an online format that can't happen if it's already in print. People can take a print pattern or a book, and they can cut it down, and they can scan it, and they can email it to whomever they like. The only thing about not publishing your own PDF is if you don't do it, you're the only person who can't benefit from your intellectual property, who can't benefit from your own creativity. So get it up there, you know, promote it, because, you know, to some degree, whether it's a criminal degree or whatever, people are going to get a hold of what they want. And if you, as you say, you know, we're not in the Napster days or, you know, those days anymore. Now we do have iTunes and ways to properly purchase things in such a way that the copyright owner is compensated. If you don't do it, you're the only person who can't benefit. So I say, you know, hey, listen, make some money for yourself, really, seriously, and get it out there and promote it properly.
Well, yeah, and so that's you know, that's a service you've done to designers and yarn companies that work with you that I think is something that's maybe not always portrayed, but you know, beyond that, there is always the motto, too, that you get what you pay for. And so if you download a free pattern from somewhere on the Internet, and there's plenty – folks, I'm not dissing free patterns. What I'm trying to say is if you download a free pattern and it doesn't work, you know, somebody can say, well, you know, I'm happy to refund your money. I think paying for a pattern, it gives the end user, you know, a little bit of security, and it also puts a little bit of onus on the supplier or designer to support that pattern as well.
Oh, completely, completely. And one of the, you know, I had, as I said, worked in the board industry before, and when you're busy, you have a life, you have a career, you have a family, whatever you've got, you know, your time is precious. And I always thought, you know, I do not mind paying, you know, $4, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 even, depending on what it's like, for a design that I know is professionally produced. I don't want to have to get halfway through a pattern. And then, you know, this is something that women always do. They always assume they get bogged down somewhere, and they assume it's their fault. Well, you know what? 90% of the time, the pattern is wrong. It's not you. It's them. But I always wanted to set Patternfish up as a place where professionals, whether you're an independent professional or a corporate professional, could have their work presented professionally. That is to say, unencumbered by distractions like advertising, where we would go in and curate to the extent that we'd make sure that there was a level of consistency in the yarn names, that, you know, spelling, you know, might be cleaned up. And this is particularly an issue with international designers. I mean, a lot of German speakers' English is way better than my German will ever be. But sometimes people need a little bit of help in, you know, formatting or grammar or whatever. We want to present people in the best possible light. If you want to come and sell your patterns on Patternfish, then, and you're a professional and it looks great, that's great. We don't editorialize. But we want to make sure that your work is presented as beautifully and nobly as it can be. I wanted people to be able to sit down with Pattern Fish almost for an evening's entertainment, you know, with a glass of wine and just look through it like you'd look through a Vogue magazine or a gardening magazine and just look at all the marvelous choices you could have. And that's still something that I find
fun. Let's talk about the methodology, too, because you were smart early on. I mean, well before anybody was thinking about cloud. You really decided that the cloud mentality was where to be. And that's made sense in so many ways. First of all, a customer's patterns are always up there for them. So if they don't have their computer or they lose their hard drive, they can log in. It's all there. But the second part of that is that even when people do their very best, there's always errata or there's always updates or corrections that need to be going. And because of your cloud methodology, they can get an updated pattern and be notified that the pattern has been updated, which I just think is really brilliant.
Well, thank you, and kudos to Phil, our programmer, for building that in at the beginning, because when we started, and as far as I know, we were absolutely one of the pioneers about this. When we started, all of the PDFs that I knew that were for sale, you would buy, maybe you'd have the right to download it 3 times, or you'd get it once, and then, you know, you had to save it somewhere. Phil, coming from a programming background and having bought all kinds of work online, like programming manuals and stuff, he said, this is where the programmers are. Once you've spent money on, now it was more in the programming world, it would tend to be like, you know, $40 or $50 for a manual. But he would say, once you've bought something in the programming world, then it stays with you. You know, you have access to, you know, further revisions of that. And, of course, I knew from, you know, the word go that we would have to provide a way for people to get errata, because it does happen from time to time that there are mistakes in patterns and they have to be corrected. So essentially the way Pattern Fish works is that there's one master copy of every pattern, and when you buy a pattern from Pattern Fish, you are buying access to the most recent version of the master pattern. So people who are very daring and talented and who have high ambitions, and I'm thinking of people like Lucy Neatby or Sibia Harding, for example, if they put out a pattern, because it is ambitious and more often than not complex, there is a certain, you know, expectation that there could be errata down the road. And with our model, all that has to happen is one new copy of the PDF gets uploaded over the old one, and then everyone sees in their pattern stash a notice saying that there's a new version of this pattern available, and you just have to click to download it. So the errata went to the customer, and as far as I know, that was groundbreaking at the time. Now, of course, you know, I guess if you're a lawyer, you'd say that you helped to set case law, you know? Now this is becoming the norm, and it's a delightful thing. It's great for the publishers, of course. When they have errata, they only have to do something once and know that their constituency has access to it. And it's great for the customer because they might get fixes to patterns that they didn't know that they would need, because not everyone knits from the pattern right away. You know, maybe you buy a pattern and then 2 years later you get around to actually sitting down and knitting it. Well, in the meantime, you've been updated with everything that, you know, has happened to that pattern.
Now, one of the things that I like, and again, you're right, this is the way people are doing it now, but you guys are really out there ahead of this. But one of the things that I like about Pattern Fish is the simplicity of the site. I can tell just from going on and having a little bit of experience, you know, with my own tech stuff, that there's a complex database that's happening in here. That you're keeping track of what a customer does, and that there's obviously some interfaces and some screens for suppliers and designers. But if you look at it, you've kept this interface so that you essentially only have 4 screens. Different kinds of screens. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's
and
a home page, and there's
a
landing page. There's a shop page where you can look at all kinds of different designs. And there's a detail page where you zero in on one. So basically, 3, and of course, your own user area where you have your pattern stash and stuff like that could count as 4. But basically, it's 3 screens, and it's really hard to get lost. You know, most people don't spend a lot of time on the home page, so they're dealing basically 2 screens, either the shop page or the detail page for any given pattern. And it enables people to be much more focused and at the same time more open about what they're looking at, what they're choosing, because it is very simple. And the search
criteria
is very simple, too.
I was going to say the search criteria is very simple and it's very easy to navigate. It's very customer-centered. And I wanted to, you know, make a point, because in order to make a complex database that simple and easy to use and to keep the choice is contextual. That takes a lot of planning and programming and thinking through from an interface standpoint as well as a database standpoint. And that's not easy. It's incredibly hard.
We thank you, and particularly Phil License thanks you, our the guy who just built this from the ground up. And I don't know if I've mentioned this already, but we went through a complete rewrite from the ground up over the last few months that was introduced in January. So if you haven't been to Pattern Fish for a few months, take a look. I mean, we are so much faster, cleaner, easier to use, and speedy. Oh, my gosh. So, but yeah, it is a tremendous amount of work. And of course, there are all kinds of things that are specific to, you know, knitting requirements. Like, you can not only search by, you know, a gauge range, but I think uniquely on our site, you can search by finished chest size as well. We had a request, interestingly enough, from someone who was a very tiny woman at the beginning saying, is there please some way that, you know, I'm a grown-up woman, but, you know, I'm the size of a 10-year-old child and I don't want to wear kids' things. I don't want to have to pick a child's category to look for a garment to wear. So we simply said, okay, yeah, sure, we'll build that in. We went back and, you know, recoded all the previous garments that had gone in before then. And now you can search by finished chest size. So and that's the blue button at the top left under the Pattern Fish logo on the shop page. It's just gauge size. What do you want to search by? So that makes things a lot easier for people who have size issues. If you're a plus size or, you know, a minus size or whatever, that, or if you know the size of your favorite sweater or someone you want to knit for, you can just go in and say, show me all the stuff that you have there.
Well, and I think it's interesting because there's two reasons that you would do an update. You know, the one of the reasons is because you want to re-index the database and offer people more choices. But the other thing is, and I know a little bit about this from my world in the hopscotch web, you have got to build a site that is compatible with every browser in the world on every platform in the world. And all of a sudden, Windows Update will come up and you'll get a brand new Explorer and stuff will break. That has happened to me many times.
It will, and it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, Phil tests on Linux platforms, on Windows platforms, on Apple platforms, and then, of course, you have all these browsers, as you say. You have Safari, you have IE, you have Firefox, you've got Opera, you know, which is more popular in Europe. You've got all these different things going on at all times, and their popularity, you know, grows and fades. We are seeing less of, you know, a concentration of Internet Explorer users now and more people going with, you know, Mozilla, Firefox, and Google Chrome certainly, you know, is a very popular one that just came out in the last, you know, couple of years. So it's brutal. It's brutal having to keep up with this. And the PDFs themselves and the messages that all the different browsers give if there's a problem can mislead the customer into thinking that they've done something wrong or that Pattern Fish has done something wrong or that your own company might have done something wrong because they'll say, this PDF is damaged and cannot be repaired. Well, that's not true. The fact of the matter is the browser has choked. You know, and maybe the customer should go and get a more recent version of Adobe and it would fix things, but that's not what they're told. So Pattern Fish does all the tech support for the patterns. That is to say, if you do have an issue with your PDF, then you can get in touch with us and we will help you. You know, we think that, you know, okay, you've paid money for this pattern and you deserve some support. And over and over again, we don't get a lot of support emails, but when we do, people always say, my gosh, you got back to me so quickly. Thank you, thank you. I have no way of knowing what service levels are like elsewhere, but I do know that over and over again people say, oh my gosh, that was so fast. I you know, wasn't expecting to hear anything back for a few days or a week or whatever. And we're like, well, you can't run a company like that. I mean, you bought our product or a product that we're agenting for other people, and you have a right to, you know, a PDF that works for you. But, yeah, it's time-consuming and awkward and horrible.
Well, and people should know that it's not like Microsoft or Apple or Mozilla checks in with folks like you and say, hey, is this okay? Is this update going to break your site? They don't do that.
From your mouth to God's ear, Benjamin, we should be first on their list.
Forget about Amazon.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Who cares about
can we pick on one of your customers and just talk a little bit about their experience? Because I think this might be interesting for our listeners to hear. One of my friends is a wonderful lady named Susan Maraca from Collage Yarns, who,
yeah,
you know,
darling Susan,
yeah, and a good friend of yours too, who raves about pattern fish. She's always happy with what pattern
Thank
fish
you.
Does for her and the, how the patterns get out there. But she also has talked to me about being able to get information off of what's selling and being able to use that as a kind of an analytic for, you know, what her customers want. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe your experiences with the good folks at Collage as well?
Indeed I can. Susie is just obviously a tremendous person to work with. She's very dynamic. She's got excellent editorial judgment. She commissions some of the best independent freelance designers in the world, as far as I'm concerned, to make things out of the lovely Collage yarns. And she's had what I consider to be the very good sense to keep her PDF centralized. Because one thing is if you list your PDFs for sale on, you know, all kinds of different platforms, it's very hard, as you say, to get a consistent picture across the internet board of what's selling for you, what's working for you, what might need more attention, what types of garments are selling and what's not. When a publisher lists with us, like Collage, for example, and by the way, if anyone wants to see their collection, just go to the patternfish.com shop page. And in the very first long window across the top, just start typing Collage Yarns and click on search, and you'll see their collection. It's lovely. Anyway, all of our sales results, you know, as I said, you know, we'll say moment by moment what's sold to, you know, what market and how much a commission you got and so on and what the pattern was. Those sales results are all exportable as a CSV file. So you can take those and you can put all of your sales results at any time of any day into a spreadsheet and manipulate that data any way you want. And more we're coming up with custom publisher reports to be able to say, this is what's working for you right now. This might need a bit more attention. Oh, look, all of a sudden there's a boom in shawlettes or whatever it might be, or people are buying vests or, you know, what have you. But they'll have information like that available to them. And the more you centralize with your PDF sales, the more you have this data all in one place where it does you the most good. So Susie has had the vision to take full advantage of that. And, of course, you know, also since she chooses wonderful patterns, has them beautifully presented and photographed, and since she's exclusive with us as PDF downloads, and we use her work a lot in our advertising because Patternfish does advertise on behalf of our clients. We don't always let them know when we do it, which we should probably do, but we do. We put together advertisements for our publishers all the time. We advertise on the internet and various different sites. We're regulars in the fall issue with Knitty.com, for example. We advertise on Ravelry. We put out tweets and Facebook notifications for milestones hit, like, you know, your 100th pattern, whoever you are, or your 150th, or, you know, this is really cool design someone's come out. We always, you know, send out notifications and keep interest alive in everyone's ongoing catalog. So we have really an ethical obligation to make our publishers successful since that's what they come to us for. And, you know, those who trust us, we want to do the best work for them that we possibly can. That's all we do is sell pattern.
I think that's a right-on answer. And you know, I think that there's that part of it as well, that you're taking good care of your publishers and you're providing an opportunity for sales and that you learn things when people buy as opposed to just going and downloading whatever's free. Because there can be a hoarding mentality that, oh, look, it's free, let's just go get
there
it.
There is.
Thing. And yeah. I think that you can learn things when people come onto your site and they search for certain things and they get certain things. I think that a publisher can learn those things. But the other part of the thing that I think you do to drive traffic, and let's make sure we talk about this. A third of your patterns are exclusive, paid professional patterns. That's a lot of unique content. That's a lot of unique content.
It is, and it's startling if you... If you're used to seeing, you know, various kinds of things out on the internet, it can be startling. It's like visiting a new continent to have these sorts of things available all of a sudden that you didn't know existed. It's really, really radically wonderful to have a look at, you know, what's available all of a sudden that you didn't know existed from Sublime, from Sirdar, from Susie at Collage, from Prism Yarn, Knitting Pure and Simple, all these people that you're not used to seeing online, or in fact online, and you can come and look at them at patternfish.com.
No, it's really great. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about is that you're always innovating as we move into the future. And so I thought I'd ask, you know, if you'd be willing to share some of maybe the new stuff that you're working on with Fiber Hooligans. Can we tempt you to give us some secrets about what's coming up soon?
I'm particularly thrilled to do that. And the first innovation, or the first wonderful new thing that we're going to be introducing to our clientele is that we are partnering with Sally Holt, who is with a company called Knit Companion. So you should go to knitcompanion.com and look at her site. She's got this tremendous app for Apple-based products for iPhones and iPads that, making a long story short, and her site explains it very well, but allows you to integrate all the complicated aspects of a pattern. Like if you buy a complicated lace garment that has lots of things going on, the pattern might be, you know, 7 pages long. This app allows you to take every single element of that pattern. If you spend a little bit of time inputting it into the app, if you take your pattern and put it into the app, then you'll be able to have row-by-row instructions, so you don't have to flip back and forth from page 7 to page 2 and figure out when you should change needle sizes or that the lace pattern changes at the same time as there's waist shaping, blah, blah, blah. This wonderful Knit Companion app does all that for you. So we are partnering with Sally because her app has been so successful, and there is such a demand for it, in selling patterns that are pre-formatted already for the Knit Companion app so that you don't actually have to spend the hour or two or however long it may be doing the formatting yourself. You can actually buy the formatted pattern just straight up, you know, plug it in and away you go. And this is going to be surprisingly affordable. If you have already bought the pattern and you want just the app enabler, then that's only going to be $3. It'll be $3 extra to get the Knit Companion formatting for your pattern. So we're really excited about that. That's coming out in the next few weeks. We will be the only people offering this, and it's just a genius move. We're so pleased to be working with Sally. Sometimes you meet someone and they've really got this fire in their eyes and stuff, and she's just like that. And the other thing we're working on, of course, which has been inevitable since, you know, we started conceptualizing this whole thing, is the wholesale model. And we have been talking, obviously, to retailers for years and end users for years, and what would make the most sense and how would this work most for you? How can we make this to be a win-win-win-win-win situation for every single person, make them all happy and not put any work on extra work on people's plates? So that's all coming together now, and after we do the Knit Companion release, then we will be able to introduce the wholesale model sometime in the next couple of months. Now, we're really excited about that because obviously it'll be in place for the fall season. We do actually have a few stores right now, about 11 of them, who are in beta with a non-financial version of this right now, where what they're doing is visible to distributors. But that is absolutely coming down the road. So we're really excited about that too.
Well,
Please
go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm horrible.
No, please. No, please. Oh, okay. Well, I'll ask. Because, you know, I know that you're not ready to talk about a lot of the technical and the logistics of the wholesale program at this point because it's still in development. And you at this point, you're trying to keep things open so that you can make the best possible product. And so you don't want to pigeonhole yourself in as while you're trying to dial things in. And I truly understand that as somebody that develops as well. But one of the things that I wanted to have a parenthetical conversation with you about is something you and I have talked about, before. In this age of the internet and, you know, really having consumers tell, you know, the industry what they want, one of the things that happens is we're in a Wild West world that
we are.
And one of those casualties can be yarn stores, and I know that you believe, just like I do, that they are so important. And I wanted you to, because you've said it so many times, I'd love for you to articulate your thoughts about the local yarn store to my listeners, if you could, please.
Well, I want to point out, first of all, that obviously I started out, having been a knitter for so long, as a customer, and then worked as a yarn rep selling yarns to yarn stores. And also simultaneously teaching classes and working as a clerk at yarn stores for like 1 or 2 days a month for close to 10 years. So I like to think that I have a real kind of a multifaceted, multidimensional view of this. And I don't think there's any question but that yarn stores, local yarn stores, bricks and mortar stores where you can actually go in and feel yarn, are the spine and the armature of our industry. You know, the rest of it, the rest of what we have is literally soft product. We've got to have these spines and armatures in which to make the whole discipline and the fiber arts real for people. And fiber arts more than most things, it's a commodity, but they're not. You have to touch a yarn. You have to see how it looks in certain lights. You have to be able to compare this yarn with the other yarn that you're thinking of buying in the real world. You need the advice of the clerks and the people in the store and the owner about what color might be more becoming to you, what texture might work better. If you are substituting yarns, they will have the biggest amount of knowledge about what might work, you know, for a given pattern versus another one. And of course, they're community hubs. You know, I mean, they provide such a valuable gathering place for knit nights and so on. They are literally the spine. And if you take away that spine, if you take away the framework on which the industry has been built, then essentially you'll have an amorphous kind of thing. And it's one of those things, Benjamin, where we won't really know the full effect of what might be able to happen or what could potentially happen in terms of disaster until we lose them. And when we lose them, then that would be a disaster. I mean, we lose a few, as we all know, every year. But they can't go away. They cannot go away. We're all so dependent on them, on the knowledge, on the camaraderie, and on the passing along of information. Oh, I mean, you know,
no,
we just get on high horses. We can ride them around all day. Yeah.
Yeah, but I agree with this, and it's hard because there are so many things about the way that the new industry works that can leave the local yarn store out in the cold. You know, if they're not aware of the options too, and I just think it's very laudable that, you know, you've come to this place and say, okay, you know, how can I include them in my process too? You know, I just think that's, you know, an ethical, right on thing.
Thank you so much. Actually, one of the reasons that Patternfish doesn't take advertising is because I couldn't figure out a way to have a yarn store be able to recommend that their customers go and look for a project that they wanted to work on our site and have flashy ads for, you know, this yarn store or that yarn store saying, okay, well, free shipping today or whatever, and distract the customer from what they wanted to do, which is, after all, get a project underway. And if they have a local yarn store that they love to go to or are happy working with, then, you know, that's a relationship that certainly we want to encourage. And I've had many retailers tell me that they feel very comfortable sending their customers to patternfish.com to look for a pattern because they can't get poached by another store. It's not possible. All they can do is come and they can look around and find a pattern and then go on back to their yarn store and say, I want to make this. What have you got? And I think that's very valuable. And as we know, yarn stores typically, you know, are not fountains of money. They don't generate oceans of cash that have to be squirreled away in offshore accounts. It's just not, that's just not what happens with most yarn stores. So what they really have to be looking at is ways that they can maximize their revenues for space. And patterns traditionally have never been a good way to do that. If patterns by themselves were a viable source of income, then there would have been pattern stores, bricks and mortar stores, on, you know, streets like yarn stores. But they never have been. And people have always, you know, had to say, well, we have to have these around to sell, you know, the main feature, which is, of course, yarn. But by taking the whole burden away from, or not the whole burden, but some of it away from the yarn stores and saying, you don't have to stock everything on the planet. You know, we have more than 16,000 patterns and a catalog that's always growing in terms of strength and reliability. We have all these things available to your customers, and your customer can come and buy, and pretty soon with your financial participation, you know, you can procure patterns for them on Patternfish, and then they can just settle down and buy what is the highest margin thing for you. I think that's very valuable for a store. So everything that we do, every decision that we make, every molecule of our attention is devoted to how can we make this a better experience for all the people involved, for the local yarn store that sells the product, because we will never sell anything that's not digital. We do not compete with the stores in any physical way. And how can we make it a good, clean experience for the customer and for the store, for the designer, for everyone? I mean, I used to joke with my friends at the beginning when Pattern Fish was starting and say, okay, well, I've got motive and I've got the means and I have the opportunity, and now we have to come up with the opposite of a crime. So I hope that's what we're doing, you know?
Well,
it can be a win-win-win.
It can be, and that's something you and I have talked about before. I've talked with a lot of people before, but we talk about the concept of being good stewards of our industry, and that is something that's not always really definable, but you are. And you're also very patient. That's something else I've always thought about you, because your concept is not always gone on you. You propose it to people, and they go, yeah, I don't get it, or I don't want it, and things. And I've been guilty of that myself.
At the beginning,
Yeah, but still, you are infinitely patient with people. You're always leaving the door open. Everybody loves you. I mean, how do you keep your cool?
I'll tell you why. It's because I feel like a missionary. I feel like it's laid on me to do this. I have this messianic kind of conviction that what we're doing is right, that it was right at the beginning, and that it's going to work over the long term. And I understand that, people who haven't thought about this for a long time or haven't been involved in tech or seen things change the way they have, that it might not come to them right away. They might not reach this rational conclusion right away. They have to do it on their own speed. And once they do make the decision that, PDFs are something I'd be interested in, then we're delighted to talk to them. But and of course, before, too, if they say, what are your arguments for doing this? I'm happy to do it. But I can't force something that shouldn't be forced. You know, people have to come to realizations and conclusions in their own time. And once they express an interest in learning more about it, I'm delighted to talk to them for as long as they want. But I can't force what should be a logical, inevitable, and pleasant decision that they're happy with. You know, I don't want to force someone into a box that they're uncomfortable in. I want them to come into it of their own free will, understanding as much as they can about their product and the consequences of not doing it and doing it.
That makes total sense, and I've always appreciated your patience, especially with us, because we're probably the last publisher in the world dragging our feet out there, and you've always so sweet to us, no matter how I drag my feet. Yeah.
Not the last.
We'll get there. So we're coming down pretty close to the end of our interview here, Julia. And so one of the questions I'd like to ask, are there any shout-outs that you'd like to make out to the world?
It's such a long list. Obviously, everyone who's ever been encouraging and helpful and said, hey, that sounds like a cool idea. All of our initial publishers who believed and were with us from before day one, who just believed in the concept. And they include, of course, Cabin Fever, Classic Elite Yarns, Veronique Avery, Robin Hunter, Mags Candace, Lana Knits, Sally Melville, the Wendy Twillies, Peter Pan, Pearl Gray, Ilgalea. I mean, it's just so many people at the beginning who were just Cornelia Hamilton, who all said, yeah, this is a great idea, and yes, you can start off with our work because we think it's great. Nothing could have been done without Phil License, who wrote all the programming and said, yes, I'd like to take this on as a project. Shannon Shields, our bookkeeper, our chancellor, actually, who pays people and keeps all the accounting on us a timely and accurate level. Our wonderful ambassador, Gail Klo, who puts together the newsletter and has just had such a great impact and makes it so much fun for our customers to revisit us all the time. My mom and dad, I guess, for giving me the excitement about being an entrepreneur, and my mother focusing that, saying, for my dad, it's like, yeah, sure, let's put on a show. And for my mom, maybe this is a way that, is such a satisfactory thing to address as a discipline. Maybe go this way. I hope. So much to both my parents. And most of all to my partner, Greg Smith, who, had he not said, yeah, sure, fine, go ahead, take a couple of years off or however long it takes to get this idea of yours off the ground. We can do without the second income, and yeah, I'm going to support you, you know, every step of the way. And if you need the odd thing done, like, you know, watermarking software or the initial software that actually took our scans and made them look like they were not scans, that whitened the white backgrounds and blackened up the text and sharpened the photos, I mean, without his first, you know, permission and second participation, again, none of this would have happened. So I just owe so much to so many people.
That's really wonderful. It's very wonderful that you remember all these people. You're a class act. So last question. She is extremely, extremely humble. You know, so much so that I was giving her a bad time earlier. I was up on the Patternfish site and looking for the About Us, and there's nothing about them. And frankly, folks, if you get a chance to meet Julia,
there is about buying and about selling, if you go to the help part. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, there is no About Us as such. We'll put that together for you, Benjamin.
Well, I want to see more about you, you know. But all right. So last question, I warn all my guests, and I warned you before we wrap this up today, I'd like to ask if you have a final message you'd like to share with our listeners.
I do. And thank you, by the way, for the heads up, because it allowed me to really think about some really interesting points. And I want to say to all of our listeners, whether you're a customer or someone who wants to get into the industry in some way, use what you have. Don't waste time thinking that, oh, if I were taller or smarter or, you know, had $1 million, I could do this or that. To a large extent, Patternfish is the way it is because of not only strengths but deficiencies. Like, I personally have kind of a terrible color sense. I can't really tell what colors go best with other colors. I don't know what looks great on people. My own knitting tastes tend to be more traditional than not. I can't spot fashion trends. I would be a terrible editorial director for a publication. But that in and of itself kind of dictated the way the site would go, that we wanted a level of professionalism amongst patterns because I don't have time to waste with poorly written, non-tech edited stuff. But it also means that I don't have an editorial policy. We do not have an editorial policy. Your pattern has to be good. It has to be professional, well-written, good in the sense that, you know, it meets a quality standard of being easy to work from, you know, making things clear. But that said, bring it. I don't care what it's for. And this kind of attitude wouldn't have happened without my deficiencies as well as a love for the industry and a willingness to promote. I always loved that scene in Apollo 13. Have you seen the movie where the engineers come along, you know, and they dump out this box of stuff onto a table and say, our astronauts are in trouble, and this is what they have to work with. And they're shaking out of the box the few things that the astronauts have to work with. I love that. Everyone has their own set of things to work with, and it's just amazing what you can do with what you've got. Look around. You'll surprise yourself.
Well, this has got to be one of the best answers I've ever had about it. So well done.
Thank you.
You've been fantastic as a guest, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I want to thank
Maybe
you
get
for
the guest
us.
You deserve, Benjamin. This has been a real pleasure.
It's a wonderful show. I'm glad that we finally got a chance to talk about you and Patternfish on the show. I've been wanting to have you on the show for a while. And so I'm going to thank you for joining us today and say goodbye to you, and I'll see you in a few weeks at TNNA.
Well, indeed. I look forward to it. And thank you for all your kindness and your generosity and giving us the opportunity to spread the Patternfish word.
All right. Well, keep the faith.
Okay, you too. Thanks, Benjamin.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Julia Grono. You can check up on what she's doing at patternfish.com. And I encourage you all to jump up there and take a look at this incredible resource. It's extremely easy to use. There's some great stuff on there. And you should especially look at those great designs that she's been talking about on the show. Okay, you know what time it is.
And now it's time for State of the Hooligan with Tammy Burke.
I'd like to welcome back host of State of the Hooligan, moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Rivalry Group, and administrator of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook page to tell us all what's new and cool in the fiber arts world, our roving virtual reporter, my friend and fellow Fiber Hooligan, Tammy Burke. Tammy joins us again today from, no, I don't believe she's in Boise, Idaho, but she's outside Boise, Idaho. Good morning, Tammy, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
All those horns make me think if you didn't have your coffee, you're definitely awake now.
Oh, my. So you're camping.
I was. I came home early this morning. Great. It was wonderful. Beautiful weather. It was supposed to get up to 80 today. So.
So how was the rest of your week?
It was pretty good. I got lots of knitting done. How about you?
You know, it
all
was a, you know what it's like. I come back from the show and, you know, I spend the first couple of days just sleeping. And then I just try to unbury my inbox and that's, you know, and then catch up on all. It's, you saw, every single time, you've been through this with me before. It's always rough to get a hold of me the week after I get back from the show. But, you know, eventually we managed to get it all together about Friday or Saturday. So I always appreciate your patience. You know, folks, she really is so patient. We, you know, we try to put together some stuff before every show, and she's, are you there? Are you alive? And, you know, I'm getting there. She's unbelievably patient. But, you know, I know you've got a great report for us today, but I knew that you had a special announcement that you wanted to make today.
Well, I wanted to say congratulations to Buffalo Wool Company, Ron and Teresa Miskin. Ron's in our chat room right now. We wanted to say congratulations on the new grandbaby daughter, Kennedy, born this weekend.
Congratulations, Ron and Teresa. That's fantastic news. And, you know, Ron, you know, we're going to have to look on, we've got to have you wearing more cardigans, you know, and put a little more gray in your beard, make you a little more grandfatherly.
Right.
Right. Right. Anyway, so, oh, he just typed wow in the okay. Yeah, he didn't know. Got plenty of gray. He says, no, you need more. You need more. Ron, the goal is not to make you look more grandfather. The goal is that when I look next to you, I just want to look a lot younger in by comparison, okay?
Whatever. gets Ron woke up this morning.
All right. So let's move on to your report. I know I always look forward to your report. So what do you got for us this week?
Well, I thought this item comes from London. It's actually a week old, but I thought it was perfect timing today with the Boston Marathon going on this morning. I know it was on the way home. I listened to a little bit of it on the radio. This was published in the Argus paper, which is in the England and Wales report. This actually was a news article that came out before the race in London, the London Marathon. They were reporting about an inspirational runner named Susie Hewer, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly, who could stitch her way. They were reporting at that time that she could stitch her way into the history books at this year's Virgin Money London Marathon while boosting funds for Alzheimer's Research UK. She will attempt to beat her own Guinness World Record for creating the longest crochet chain while running the marathon. This was Sunday, April 13th, last week. She's known as the Extreme Knitting Redhead and will run in memory of her mom, Peggy, who died of vascular dementia in 2005 at age 89. Susie took up running in 2002 and ran her first marathon 2 weeks after losing her mother. Her current crochet record is, and they gave this in meters, it's been converted to feet for us non-metric folk, is 253 feet. That was her original record that she was attempting to beat. And also her time, I think, gave her her time that she's hoping to beat was 5 hours, 42 minutes, she was the first person to run a marathon while knitting and setting a Guinness World Records for she's already set a Guinness World Record for creating the longest scarf in the over 26-mile distance. She's recognized as having raised over 30,000 pounds to date for Alzheimer's and dementia research. So after the article was published last Monday, I believe this was her blog post at extremeknittingredhead.blogspot.com. She finished the race in 5 hours, 40 minutes, which is 2 minutes faster than her previous time. Her chain measured 457 feet, which was nearly doubled the record she was trying to beat. So that was pretty an amazing accomplishment. The chain that she's crocheted will be included in a blanket that will be donated to someone suffering dementia. And actually, in the blog post, she said that she ended up with so much more than she expected that she's thinking she's going to have another blanket made out of it, too. So our congratulations go out to Susie and her new Guinness record. She said in her blog, it's wonderful to have another world record, but I really hope that people understand the metaphor of the chain, which links people suffering from dementia together. And I think that it does more than that personally. It links all of us who are trying to make our world a better world one stitch at a time.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, wasn't that cool?
That is very cool. Wow, I just almost got chills. That is an awesome story.
Almost doubling your own record is incredible, but doing that and still getting the time down, bringing her time of the race down, I thought was pretty amazing. I can understand, you know, if you slowed down a little bit and had a little bit longer time to achieve such a length of crochet, but you know, really awesome, and clearly she was you know, well reported on in that area for her achievement. So good job.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wow. Wow, that's incredible. Well, you know, I'm always amazed at these great stories that you find. And this one especially, very inspirational. You know, the record's great and all that, but the sentiment behind the record, what she said, just amazing. Really, really,
yeah.
you know, wonderful. That's fantastic. Okay, well, do you have anything else you want to share with us this week at all?
Nope, I think that covers that. We've covered so much today. I'm looking forward to getting into that Pattern Fish website a little bit more.
Isn't Julia wonderful?
Yes, it was a great program today.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you, it seems like we can't go wrong with those Canadians, you know?
Yeah, it was great. I hope you have an awesome week, Benjamin. Happy Monday.
Well, thank you. Happy Monday, you too, and we'll look forward to hearing from you on next week's show, Tammy. You take it easy and keep on knitting.
Thank you. I will.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Tammy Burke, host of State of the Hooligan and moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook group and Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group. For those of you who may have missed anything in today's podcast, I invite you to join us on one of our groups. Tammy does a great job of making sure we answer questions and provide links and follow-up to anything you might have heard on the show. Next week, my guest will be Laura Zander of Jimmy Bean's Wools. Originally from North Carolina, Laura earned a master's in poli-sci, but switched gears while earning her PhD to computer programming, a favorite subject of hers. After lots of hard work, she landed a software developing job in Palo Alto, which is where Laura met her future husband, Doug. Wanting a change from the hectic pace of Silicon Valley, they moved to scenic Tahoe, where Laura started to design websites for small companies. During this time, she learned to knit and loved it, which is how Laura met Lorna, owner of a local hand-dyed yarn company. She encouraged Laura to follow her true passion, knitting, and voila, Doug and Laura emptied their savings account, and Jimmy Bean's Wools was born. Laura is one of the most savvy business people in the fiber arts world, and I'm so happy to be able to have her on the podcast. You're going to learn a lot, folks, so I hope you'll tune in next week for what should be a great show. I also wanted to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. And that includes suggestions for guests or cool things you'd like Tammy to talk about in her segment. Of course, if you wanted to email Tammy directly, you can do so by emailing her directly at tammy@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. And if you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, I may even read your email or message on the podcast. Well, that's our show, Fiber Hooligans. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, The only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. The good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. We'll see you next week on another edition of Fiber Hooligan.